Hey everyone, welcome back to Deep Dive. We're about to, well, you know, we're about to dive deep. Deep into some fascinating stuff today. We're going to be exploring a pretty huge concept, you know, social justice, but with like a twist, a historical twist. We're going way back to ancient Israel.
Yeah, we're going way back. So our main source today, well, it's a lecture by Dr. Michael Harbin, and it's a really thought-provoking one.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking like, you know, how social justice was understood in that ancient context. And, you know, it's part of the series he's doing, Social Justice for Social Outliers in Ancient Israel. Pretty catchy title, huh? And the specific lecture is part three. So we're kind of in the middle of things here.
Right, right. And this one really tackles, I mean, head on, you know, like, what is social justice? Like, what does it even mean?
Yeah. And the cool thing is it's, you know, it's coming from his work on like his upcoming commentary on Leviticus. So, you know, we're getting a bit of a sneak peek into, like, the core ideas he's been uncovering.
Exactly. Exactly. Sneak peek. Yeah.
So, Dr. Harbin, like, right off the bat, he takes us back way back to the late Bronze Age.
Right.
This is when, you know, God gives the Torah and the land to Israel.
Right.
And he makes this point that, you know, Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, like, it's not just this random collection of, you know, rules and regulations. It's more like, you know, if you think of it like a blueprint, a blueprint for unifying this new nation, this, you know, kingdom of priests, as they're called. And get this, the book, it's structured in two parts, two main parts.
Right. Okay.
One focuses on, you know, how they were supposed to worship together.
Right.
Corporate worship. And the other one, well, it lays out like the essential guidelines for how they were meant to, you know, live together as a society, like the fabric of their community.
Right. And it's important to kind of remember where they're coming from, like the context here. So after that, well, after the, you know, not so successful experience at Kadesh Barnea.
Right.
The Israelites, they spent, you know, 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And when they finally make it to the promised land, they're not all concentrated in one place.
Right.
You know, they're spread out over, you know, over a bunch of smaller communities, relatively isolated communities.
Almost like a network, a patchwork of villages, you could say.
Yeah, yeah, precisely, like a patchwork. But here's the thing. These communities, they weren't totally disconnected. They were bound together by, you know, some really important things, common ancestry, right? Yeah. That shared Exodus story, huge for them. Their system of worship, you know, worshiping the same God. And of course, you know, the societal teachings that they'd received.
Thanks.
So for this deep dive, our mission, what we want to do is really try to understand these principles of social justice, how they were, you know, woven into the Torah, like, you know, the teaching given by God. And then, like, we want to see how that ancient understanding, you know, how does it measure up against, you know, how we think about social justice today? Like, does it line up? Does it clash? Like, where do we see the connections and the differences?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. So let's start with, like, you know, how we understand social justice today, you know, in the modern world.
Okay.
And Dr. Harbin, right away, he makes this key point that the actual term, the term social justice, you won't find it in the Old Testament itself.
Right, right.
Like the words aren't there, even though the ideas are definitely present.
Exactly, exactly. It's the ideas, not the exact words.
So it's this distinction between the concept and the label.
Right.
And he traces the term back, you know, does some digging, and it's the mid-19th century. Specifically 1840. There's this Italian priest, Luigi Taparelli Zazzeglio.
Yeah.
And interestingly, both he and Michael Novak, they agree that the initial definition, it was pretty broad, like not super well defined, you know.
Kind of like a rough draft, a very early stage of an idea.
Right. And then Novak in a 2009 lecture, he breaks down five popular ways that the term social justice is used today.
Okay.
So the first one is, you know, distribution. And you know, you'll see this in dictionaries. You'll see it on Wikipedia. Basically, it's about, you know, how all the good stuff and the bad stuff in society, you know, like wealth, opportunities, disadvantages, how it's spread out, how it's divided.
Is it who gets what and who doesn't?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And this often gets linked to, you know, the idea of government stepping in. The government stepping in to kind of manage this distribution.
Right.
Make sure it's fair in their eyes. And this is where Novak actually kind of raises some questions. He suggests that it kind of implies this external force, right? This extra human force, as he calls it, that's kind of doing this distributing.
That's interesting. So, like, instead of it being a natural outcome of, I don't know, like, people's choices, people's actions,
yeah,
it's like someone or something else is deciding who gets what and how much.
Right. Exactly. Like, it's a top-down kind of approach.
Yeah.
And then there's equality. You know, just the idea that equality is good, right?
Yeah,
equality is a good thing, and we should be promoting it. But Novak, he argues that this can actually, you know, distort the meaning of equality. Like separated from these other ideas that are kind of related, like fairness and equity. And he gives this really relatable analogy. So imagine you give like the exact same size piece of cake, right? Same size of piece of cake. You give it to like a young child, a child who's like not even hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you give that same size piece of cake to like a teenager who's just come in from like football practice.
Right.
And he's starving.
Ravenous.
Ravenous. Exactly. Is that really fair?
Right. Even though it's equal in terms of like the literal size of the pieces.
Exactly.
It's not really fair given like their different needs and their different situations.
Right. It really highlights that, you know, it's not just about treating everyone the same, but treating everyone fairly based on, you know, what they need, where they are.
Exactly.
And then the next way he sees social justice being used is the common good. And, you know, this is a concept. This concept goes way, way back.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking Aristotle, ancient Greece.
Exactly.
Kind of
saying. Exactly. But the challenge here, as Novak sees it, is who gets to define,
yeah,
right? Who gets to define what the common good is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in those smaller communities, you know, way back when, maybe it was the elders or the strongest leaders.
Right.
But in modern times, Novak suggests that the government, you know, the government has kind of increasingly taken on this role.
Mm-hmm.
And he's concerned that this can lead to these bureaucracies, to these big systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they're not really accountable to the people.
Right.
And, you know, in extreme cases, he even mentions, you know, totalitarianism.
Whoa. Okay. So the seemingly simple idea, right, the common good, it raises some pretty big questions for us. Like, you know, who has the authority, you know, the right, the wisdom to actually say, like, this is what's best for everyone.
Right.
And maybe even more importantly, like, how do we actually make sure that power, that authority doesn't get misused or doesn't just, you know, serve the interests of a small group?
Right. How do you prevent that?
Yeah.
And the fourth way Novak sees social justice being used is as kind of a progressive agenda.
Okay.
And he argues, like, that this idea really gained traction, you know, in Europe during the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was a response to like all this change, right? Mm-hmm. All this huge change happening, people leaving farms, you know, moving to cities, going to factories.
Yeah, huge societal shifts.
Huge societal shifts and often facing a lot of new hardships, a lot of new struggles. So it was about, you know, trying to correct, you know, the wrongs that came out of that whole process.
Okay, so it's an understanding of social justice that's very much rooted in a specific time and place.
Exactly.
And trying to address those specific problems that came along with that specific transition, you know, from rural to industrial, from agrarian to urban.
Right. And then finally there's compassion. You know, compassion, and it's become kind of like a catchphrase for, you know, any action,
mm-hmm,
and any action that's supposedly, you know, helping the poor, helping those in need. But Novak, he issues this really strong warning here. Like,
yeah,
he actually says that some of the most horrific, some of the most horrific events in history, he mentions the Nazis, he mentions communist regimes.
Oh, wow.
Were actually carried out in the name of compassion.
Right.
Or helping humanity,
wow,
you know?
Oh,
awesome. So it's a really sobering thought.
Yeah, no kidding. It really makes you think about, you know, the intentions behind things, right? Like good intentions.
Yeah.
They don't automatically mean, you know, good results. And sometimes they can even be twisted, you know, to justify some pretty terrible actions. Yeah.
Twisted to justify some pretty terrible actions. So out of all these different ways, all these different ways that, you know, the term is used, Dr. Harbin notes that the most common understanding of social justice today seems to be, you know, centered around this idea of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that we should be dividing things fairly, you know, wealth, opportunities, privileges.
Mm-hmm.
And he even shares some definitions, like from actual organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like the National Association of Social Workers.
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, equal economic, political and social rights and opportunities for everyone. And then Appalachian State University, they have an Office of Social Justice and Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they emphasize equitable treatment, mm-hmm. you know, support for human rights and the fair allocation of community resources.
And Harbin, he points out that, you know, on the surface, these definitions, right, they sound really good.
Yeah.
Like, who wouldn't want equal rights and opportunities? And they echo, you know, some of the ideals we see in, like, the Declaration of Independence, right? That all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights.
Is it?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But he also says, you know, right away, these definitions, they bring up some pretty fundamental questions, like some really big questions.
Yeah, big questions. So the first one is, you know, like, what is a right?
Right.
Like, what actually constitutes a right? And even more fundamentally, like who gets to decide, you know, what are these rights? Like, where does that authority come from?
Yeah.
And Thomas Jefferson, you know, he firmly believed that these rights, they were given to us by our creator.
Right.
It's a very Judeo-Christian perspective.
Right. It's rooted in a specific worldview.
Exactly.
That there's, you know, there's a God and he's given us these rights.
Mm.
But Harbin explains that this poses a real challenge, like a significant challenge for people who don't hold that Judeo-Christian worldview.
Right.
You know, particularly, you know, agnostics or atheists. If you're coming from a purely evolutionary standpoint, you know, like, life is about survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
The idea of inherent equal rights for everyone, it kind of falls apart.
Yeah.
Like, there's no inherent moral basis for those kinds of rights in a purely materialistic worldview.
Yeah.
You know, where it's all just about competition.
Right, right. It becomes kind of arbitrary almost.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Arbitrary.
And then there's the issue of conflicting rights.
Yeah.
You know, like what happens when one person's, you know, right, or what they perceive as their right,
mm-hmm.
clashes directly with someone else's.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Harbin, he brings up this concept, yeah, John Locke's concept of fair allocation.
Okay.
And he uses the analogy of gathering acorns.
Acorns.
Acorns. You know, like you only have a legitimate claim to the acorns that you can use, the acorns that you can actually use, you know, before they spoil.
Okay.
Anything beyond that,
mm-hmm.
not really yours, not your fair share.
Okay. So it's like, you know, take what you need. But don't be greedy. Don't hoard.
Exactly. Exactly. But here's where it gets interesting.
Okay.
Harbin explains that, you know, that analogy, it has its limitations.
Okay.
Really, it only applies to, you know, things that are yeah. perishable.
Right.
Things that go bad.
Things that will rot or spoil if you don't use them quickly enough.
Right. And things that are, you know, that are freely available.
Right.
Common resources.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't easily translate to non-perishables.
Yeah.
You know, like what about, you know, I don't know, tools or
gold.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Or to private property. You know, yeah. what if yeah. that oak tree, right?
Right.
What if that oak tree with all those acorns is on land that you own?
Right.
Do you suddenly lose your right to, you know, all those extra acorns?
Yeah. It gets tricky.
It gets tricky. Exactly.
And what if the shade from that oak tree, you know, on your property, what if it starts like damaging your neighbor's garden?
Yep.
Like, does your right to have a tree, does it trump their right to, I don't know, grow vegetables or whatever they have in their garden?
Exactly. And it highlights the fact that rights, they're not absolute.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one person's rights, they can't infringe on someone else's, you know, well-being or property.
Right. It's a balancing act.
It's a balancing act. Exactly. And then the discussion shifts to opportunity.
Okay.
Right. You know, what does it really mean? Like, what does it really mean to say that everyone should have an equal opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we even begin to address, like, all the different things that can prevent that?
Yeah.
You know, and the general consensus, like the general idea today, is that we should, we should focus on eliminating these artificial barriers. You know, things like discrimination.
Right.
Based on race, gender, beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for people who are otherwise qualified.
Right.
But Harbin makes this distinction, this really important distinction between these, you know, artificial barriers and what he calls real barriers.
Oh, okay.
And he notes that there's often a lot of, like, confusion about this in modern discussions.
Right.
And he points out that there are so many other factors, so many other things that can influence the opportunities that we have. And it's not about discrimination necessarily.
Right.
You know, it's things like, you know, your parents and how they raised you,
mm-hmm.
you know, your siblings, you know, the quality of the schools you go to, where you live.
Yeah.
You know, like geographically.
Where natural abilities, like what you're good at, what you're not good at.
Exactly. Your natural talents,
mm-hmm.
you know, strengths, weaknesses.
Kind of dislikes.
Yeah, your likes and dislikes.
And Harbin, he gives this really interesting example. It's from the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 19,
right.
where Jesus talks about eunuchs.
Oh, right.
Right. And there are like different types of eunuchs, right?
Yeah.
Some who were born that way, some who were made that way by other people.
Right.
And some who chose that path.
For the kingdom, right.
Right, right. So it's like this illustration of how some limitations on opportunity, like they're just part of life.
Yeah, just part of being human.
Yeah.
And then as Ecclesiastes reminds us, you know, there are just accidents.
Accidents?
You know,
yeah.
Time and chance overtake them all. This, you know.
Things happen,
exactly. And even when opportunities are there, it doesn't guarantee success.
Right.
You know, and Harbin, he brings up like the high failure rates for new businesses, you know,
mm-hmm.
even with access to resources and the fact that, you know, almost half of college students, they don't graduate within 6 years.
Wow.
You know, and it's often due to factors like, you know, preparation. Maybe they weren't, you know, academically prepared,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, a lack of resources, lack of financial resources, mm-hmm. and sometimes just a lack of motivation or ability,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And he also acknowledges, he also doesn't shy away from the fact that sometimes our own choices, you know, our own moral failings, they can get in the way.
Yeah.
Like they can really hinder our opportunities and our success, like making bad decisions, you know, doing things that are unethical.
Yeah.
They can really derail someone's potential.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So Harbin concludes, you know, he kind of concludes that many modern definitions of social justice, they present a kind of, you know, truncated, as he calls it, you know, kind of a limited.
Incomplete
concept.
Mm-hmm.
One that's really focused, you know, it's really focused on what individuals should get, you know, like the fair share, that elusive fair share.
Yeah.
But without really ever defining what fair even means.
Right. Like fair to who? Fair based on what?
Exactly. Exactly. And he suggests that, you know, this focus on what we should get, it can often be, you know, be driven by some not so great emotions, you know, like jealousy, greed. Right. And plus, like, even the idea of distribution, it's kind of ambiguous. Like, are we talking about, you know, meeting people's basic needs or are we talking about, you know, fulfilling everyone's wants, you know?
Right. Needs versus wants.
Exactly. Exactly. Needs versus wants. And there's this, you know, emphasis on not just counteracting disadvantages, but lately, even trying to, you know, eliminate advantages, regardless of, you know, how those advantages were obtained. So it's like, regardless of, you know, effort or talent or anything else. It's just like, let's just make everything equal.
Level the playing field.
Exactly.
But Harbin argues that what's often missing from this modern view, of social justice, is a consideration of what people should actually contribute.
Right.
Like it's all about what we get, but what about what we give?
This, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's all about receiving, but what about our responsibilities?
Mm-hmm.
And he brings in the work of Clayton and Williams,
right.
And they offer this broader definition of social justice. So they say it involves decisions that affect not just the distribution of benefits, but also the distribution of burdens.
Okay.
Right. So true social justice, you know, it encompasses wealth, you know, opportunities, privileges, and also the production of that wealth,
mm-hmm.
the dangers, the difficulties involved in, in producing that wealth and the responsibilities.
So it's a two-way street.
It's a two-way street. Exactly.
It's not just about getting your piece of the pie, but it's also about, you know, helping to bake the pie in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly. And it boils down to two questions, two fundamental questions. You know, like, am I getting my fair share of the benefits?
Okay. Well, that's the first question.
That's the first question. And then equally important, am I carrying my fair load of the burdens?
Okay.
And Harbin really emphasizes that this second question.
Right.
About our responsibilities, about our contribution. It's often overlooked.
It's overlooked.
In these conversations today.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone wants to talk about their rights, but nobody wants to talk about their responsibilities.
Exactly. Exactly. And historically, these two ideas, fair share and fair load, they were linked, you know, intrinsically linked. Like, you know, Jesus said in Luke 12:48, from everyone who has been given much will be required.
Right.
It's that responsibility that becomes with having more resources, with having more ability.
Right. More blessings, more responsibility.
Exactly. And there's even that, you know, old French expression, noblesse oblige.
Yeah.
You know, which speaks to this idea that if you have privilege, you have obligations.
Even Karl Marx, you know, in his early writings, he kind of touched upon this idea, you know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. It's connecting, right? Connecting the idea of, you know, fair distribution.
Yeah.
Fair distribution of resources to someone's capacity to work, to contribute.
To their ability, to their willingness.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if you're able to work, you should work. And then you get, you know, what you need.
Right. But Dr. Harbin, he critiques some of the more, you know, progressive, I guess you could say,
yeah,
you know, views, you know, that really emphasize equal portions, you know, collective ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And he argues that they, you know, they tend to ignore the ability side. You know,
right.
The fair load, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not just about, like, getting an equal slice of the pie, but it's also about, like, who's baking the pie?
Right.
Sure. And are they all putting in the same effort?
Right.
And he sees it as kind of a, you know, a naive view of human nature.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Whether you look at it from, you know, the biblical perspective, you know, we're fallen. You know, we have this tendency toward selfishness. Or from, you know, an evolutionary perspective,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
We're wired for self-preservation,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Right.
And the example of the early Plymouth plantation, you know, it kind of illustrates this point really, really well. So they tried this communal system, you know, William Bradford called it the common course and condition. And it led to like widespread inefficiency. I mean, they were almost starving.
Really?
Yeah. It wasn't until they moved to a system of private land ownership.
Okay.
That they started to see like real increase in industry and productivity.
So it's like that, you know, that old saying, what's everyone's is no one's.
Exactly. Exactly. And then John Locke, you know, he offered this alternative to Marx's, you know, ideas about collective ownership. And Locke's idea was about private property, you know, mm-hmm, private property acquired through labor.
Okay.
And he had this kind of limit on it. You know, you could only acquire what you could use before it's spoiled.
Right, the acorn principle.
The acorn principle.
Yeah.
But Dr. Harbin points out some limitations with this view as well. Like, what do you do with, you know, surplus production of things that don't perish?
Right. Like if I grow way more wheat than I can eat.
Right.
What happens to the rest of it?
Exactly. What happens to the rest of it? The acorn analogy.
Mm.
It